If he couldn't fight, he wanted that. He hoped Chas was faring better than he was. He forced himself not to think of Quell at all. Two. Chas Nechatic floated with the rest of the Cerberon system's garbage. She was sprawled across the B-Wing's console, with her face pressed to the canopy bubble and her legs and feet tangled loosely in her seat harness. The transparent metal felt solid and cool against her cheek as she took in the glittering darkness, and she occasionally thumbed her audio system, restlessly switching from one song to the next, but never really listening. She had survived again. She'd survived a battle no one else had. By now, she should have been used to it. It was over 3 hours since the battle above Katatra, and no ships had appeared on her scanners. She'd picked up no transmissions. However the fight had ended, it hadn't been good for the New Republic. Maybe hadn't been good for Shadow Wing either, though she had no way to guess. As the minutes had ticked by, she'd gone from frustration to rage to despair, and then, after she'd slammed her head against the canopy, gone into a state of boneless dispassion. She thought about Will and Nath and Quell, all of whom were likely dead. Except Quell, maybe, the only one whose death Chas might actually enjoy. The thought was a stone in her throat, but she knew the hurt wouldn't last. She'd put Will and Nath away the same way she had Fatime and Yprexi and Quasail, the dead of Hound Squadron, whom she rarely thought of anymore, or even Batriok and Snivel of the Cavern Angels. You loved Snivel. You loved Snivel. When's the last time you thought of him? It would be the same with Alphabet Squadron. She smashed her forehead into the canopy again to drive sensation into her skull. Her mouth hung open as she tried to breathe, and she heard herself laughing. Little dancing blotches of light orbited the asteroids outside. She thought about Jyn Erso, the woman who'd given her life to stop the Emperor's first Death Star. The woman whose sacrifice had inspired Chas to follow in her footsteps to ruined Jeddah. Inspired her to join the Cavern Angels. Chas had heard more than her share of martyr tales as a child, been lectured over and over about the reincarnation of Howeth Zalbra and Father Kashavan's Day of Atonement. But those had been lies meant to manipulate the credulous. Jyn had been real. Chas was the antithesis of everything Jyn Erso was. Where Jyn died, Chas lived. Where Jyn brought life, Chas left the burnt corpses of friends in her wake. Jyn had fought an impossible war against an overwhelming enemy. Chas was finishing an easy war from a position of strength, even if the New Republic was having a bad day. She heard a buzzing sound over the soft music and, in her haze of pain and self-pity, thought it was an insect. She slapped at the console, expecting to feel the chitinous shell of something beneath her palm. When she realized the sound was one of the ship's alarms, she slithered back into her seat and scanned her readouts. Her oxygen gauge showed a malfunction. Might have been a leaking tank, might have been a damaged sensor. She swore softly and sucked in a long breath. Tastes fine to me, she thought, but the indicator didn't stop flashing. 2 minutes later, it still hadn't stopped. You want to wait around? Suffocation's slow, but it'll put you to sleep before the end. The idea wasn't appealing. She reached under her seat to where she'd stowed her sidearm, the custom KD-30 with its acid-packed rounds, and nudged the barrel with her fingertip. It was there if she needed it. But the thought of her brain dissolving into organic mush was no more appealing than suffocation. Possibly more painful, too. Going out there, then, she muttered, and began rummaging through the emergency supplies. She hoped someone from the ground crew had replenished those recently, even if they hadn't refueled her in time. A B-Wing's oxygen tanks were accessible from an exterior maintenance panel to the rear of the cockpit pod. Theoretically, the tanks could also be accessed by dismantling the bulkhead behind the pilot seat, but Chess thought, what was the point? If she was going to find damage, it would be outside. She didn't pull up the ship's schematics or search for the emergency manual. Chess knew her B-wing from bones to bolts, knew her fighter as well as Nath knew his, and better than Quell had ever figured out her X-wing. The Cavern Angels had forced that discipline onto her, even if she'd resented the hours reading technical sheets and reassembling model engines. Nonetheless, she mentally reviewed the diagnostic process and repair sequences twice before strapping on her rebreather, sealing her oversized flight suit, securing the cockpit's stray objects, and overriding the safety controls to shut down life support. When the air in the cockpit had been extracted and stored, and gravity had dissipated like an unwelcome odor, she slid open the canopy and let darkness inside. Space engulfed her. The last remnants of oxygen hissed away as Chas gripped her control yoke and floated free. She instinctively breathed faster, then she forced her respiration back to a steady rate and let go of the yoke with one hand, wrapping gloved fingers around the canopy's empty channel. Slowly, slowly. Hand over hand, she pulled herself out of the cockpit proper and over the edge. Her legs swung away from the ship, and she twisted and kicked, using her grip on the hull for leverage until her feet awkwardly hugged her primary airfoil beneath the cockpit pod. She wouldn't be able to cling to it all the way, but momentary security was better than none at all. She'd seen comrades sucked into space through holes blown in battleships. Some spacers developed phobias after sights like that, but Chas had only found it ugly. Maybe that's what happened to Quell when the destroyer met the Lodestar. She crept along the exterior of the pod, reaching out her left arm half a meter, finding a hold, pulling part way, and crossing over with the right arm. Grips weren't difficult to find near the canopy, but soon she was forced to stretch, to cling to jutting metal knobs or squeeze airfoil ridges with her knees. If her neck tilted back too far, she was confronted with the infinite darkness that made stillness feel like falling. When she caught a glimpse of the burning eye of the Cerberon singularity, its gaze was almost a relief. If it was down, the rest of the universe was up. Slowly, slowly. It couldn't have taken more than 5 minutes to reach the rear of the ship, but it felt like an hour. She gripped the gyro stabilizers with one hand as she eyed a scorched and cratered hull panel. She'd tucked a multi-tool into her flight suit, but she didn't think she'd need it now. She reached into the burnt hull and tugged, working the whole plate free. The metal was still warm beneath her fingers. She let go of the plate and allowed it to float away. Inside the compartment, wires and tubing packed every centimeter not occupied by the two rust-colored liquid oxygen tanks. The tanks appeared unharmed. When she ran her hand over the metal, she felt no seepage or fractures. Sensor fault. Has to be. She let out a breath and felt moisture accumulate around her lips inside the rebreather tube. If she died today, it wouldn't be by suffocation after all. Then the wires flashed silently. A spark burst from the compartment. Unthinking and surprised, she pushed away from the ship and the danger. She realized her mistake almost in time to correct it, but the B-wing was out of reach in an instant, and she was languidly drifting backward. She glanced about as if she might find a convenient tree branch or scaffold to catch, but there was nothing. She kicked against vacuum, tried to stretch out her arms as her ship and her life pulled steadily away. She'd been taught about zero-gravity maneuvering, but that had been ages ago, and panic flooded her brain. Start simple. If nothing stops you, you'll float in the same direction forever. She remembered the multi-tool. Throw it, she thought. If she hurled it away from the ship, it would push her back toward the B-wing. She managed to fumble it out of her suit, but she struggled to spin around. When she finally tossed the tool away, it barely slowed her. Meter by meter, the distance between Chas and the B-Wing increased. If she'd brought her sidearm, she could have fired it. That would have been enough kick to carry her back. She checked her suit pockets, but the weapon was still in the cockpit. If she'd been in an X-Wing or a Y-Wing, a starfighter with an astromech, she could have asked her droid to pilot the ship to her. She ran through scenarios as her mind screamed, "Think faster!" She only had a few minutes of oxygen in the rebreather. Maybe she'd be suffocating after all. The B-Wing wasn't far. On the ground, she could have reached the cockpit in seconds. She almost wished it would disappear into the distance. It would have felt like less of a mockery. If your death had to be pointless, you could have at least died in battle. She drifted and breathed and was surprised to feel her eyes water. This wasn't how she'd ever wanted to go, not in her darkest moments, not when Shadow Wing had taken everything from her, or when she'd been lost on Uchinau, or when she'd first broken free of the wretched life her mother had given her. She wondered how long it would be before her corpse joined the debris and fell, burning forever, into the eye of Cerberon. As her vision shivered and oxygen deprivation ate her brain like an acid-packed bullet, she thought she saw lights. Three. The freighter cockpit was cold, but Quell was sweating. Every muscle had begun to cramp, and her fingers and wrists had settled into the liminal space between numbness and agony. For 5 hours, she'd sat hunched in her seat, metal frame digging into her back and bottom through threadbare padding, attempting to navigate the debris field with a single maneuvering thruster. She had no repulsors, no primary jets. She could nudge the vessel to port, and she'd done so repeatedly as the ship had drifted into ever denser rock clusters. Now whirling stones spun around moon-sized asteroids, and she rationed her thruster usage in concession to the screaming red warnings that appeared with every ignition. She couldn't turn around, and the tides of gravity had put her on a course for the black hole at the heart of the system. She should have been worried about that. But every minute she avoided a fatal collision was a victory, and exhaustion guaranteed that she would make a mistake long before the black hole became a problem. During the brief, unnerving periods when no rocks hurtled toward her, Quell thought about Major Soren Keyes. The freighter's flight recorders were damaged beyond repair, and she had no way of reviewing the footage of the TIE fighter that had crippled her. Yet she had an excellent memory, and she replayed the TIE's maneuvers in her mind, finding no other conclusion than that her mentor had rejoined Shadow Wing. It was Keyes who had told her to leave after Necronus, ordered her to leave, and he'd promised he would follow. Had he betrayed her? Had he lied to her to ensure that she did as commanded? Did it even matter anymore? Had she betrayed him? A scream came from the access corridor, hoarse and short-lived. The interrogation droid had taken to injecting its patient with stimulants to keep him alert. Quell was growing used to the sounds. She'd asked the droid to make repairs to the vessel, to calculate some escape from the debris field, to take a fraction of the burden of rescue from her. But neither the droid nor Aiden had any skills she could use. They'd applied emergency sealant to two gaping holes in the hull, but the droid knew less about fixing drive systems than Quell did. Even if Aiden had been healthy, she doubted he'd be any better equipped. She looked between the viewport and her sensors as the ship approached another asteroid. She gave the maneuvering thruster a 2-second burst of power and sidestepped death. No new warning lights flared. The ignition jets would last her a little longer yet. As she scanned for the next obstacle, a sensor readout caught her attention. "Ida," she called, "get in here if you can leave your patient." A minute later, the droid's soft hum joined the uneven throbbing of the engine. She didn't dare turn around, but she flapped a hand at the console. "There's an energy reading. Looks like it's coming from a planetoid, faint but steady." You recognize it? The droid floated over the console, edging into Quell's peripheral vision.
I do not,
it said.
But I recognize the region.
So do I. Quell forced herself not to look over. She couldn't read the droid's expression anyway, and she wouldn't allow herself to be distracted. Aiden's captors were charting this area of the debris field, or they'd been here, or were planning to.
I agree it has some significance given the energy reading, but we are too far outside my specialization for me to speculate further.
It's something, though, she said, almost whispering. It's something.
Aiden is awake.
The droid's hum fell in pitch. Quell wondered if it was trying to calm her.
Given what he said, I find it unlikely that he has any information about his captor's interest in this region. However, I will inquire if you wish.
Quell tapped at the console, calculating potential approach vectors and liking none of them. No point. If I'm going to get us there, I need to adjust our angle now.
You intend to land on the planetoid?
She laughed through dry lips. It's that or keep floating until we hit something, but I'm not sure I'd call what we're about to do landing. The droid floated in the direction of the access corridor.
I'll secure Aiden and myself. What do you expect to find?
Quell shrugged. I don't expect anything. A ship, if we're lucky. A fading nav beacon, if we're not. If the droid replied, she didn't hear it. She ignited the maneuvering thruster, watching heat and power readings spike and course projections alter on her flickering display. The freighter roared in protest, and Quell bounced in her seat. But this wasn't the challenging part. If she timed the ignition burst perfectly, aligned the ship's vector with what she'd plotted on the computer without destroying her drive system entirely, she'd go racing directly for the planetoid with no way to stop. No way to slow down, except whatever atmospheric friction she might encounter. She checked her harness and leaned back in her seat for the first time in hours. Relax, she told herself. It'll probably be over soon.
Chapter 14. The Joyous Togetherness of Shared Suffering. 1. Colonel Soren Keyes walked through the dim corridors of Radakia Plaza Communications Center with his flight helmet under his left arm and his blaster comfortably gripped in his right hand. Through the floor plating, the dark, burnished Durasteel common to Imperial facilities everywhere, unable to entirely cover the stained wooden floorboards prized by aristocrats from an earlier era, he felt the rumble of proton bombs detonating kilometers away. As he walked, he hummed. Then, prompted by his own humming, he began to sing softly. Tack into the danger, boys, onward through the night. Upon the morrow we'll hoist our flag and set Queen Gan alight. It was a Corellian trader's song, one that went back centuries and whose lyrics were full of nonsense words, references to mizzens and marlin spikes and anchor roads. The song recounted a perilous voyage, and when Soren realized why he was singing it, he stopped abruptly. It had been Captain Gablerone's favored drinking song. Soren had never liked Gablerone, but they had been comrades for an eternity. Now, Gablerone was dead, incinerated at some point during the final battle above Troyth. When and how, Soren had yet to learn. Gablerone was not the first casualty of the assault on Cerberon, nor, Soren was sure, would he be the last. He resisted the urge to kick the door panel as he arrived at the entrance to the control chamber. He smoothed out his breathing, tapped the trigger, and stepped inside to join his people. He'd chosen Radakia Plaza as a landing zone and temporary operations hub based on what he recalled from his studies of Troyth prior to the attack. Soren had never considered himself studious or possessed of a particularly keen intellect. He thought of Lieutenant Quell's obsessiveness, but a soldier survived by preparing for contingencies. The comm center had been abandoned soon after Endor when the governor had ordered the redeployment of all planetside troops. Yet, it was deep within territory historically friendly to Imperial rule. It was not safe, only a fool would call it safe, but it was a better location than most to regroup. The pilots already inside came from every squadron in the 204th. Their ties had been damaged or required refueling and repair, while their comrades continued bombing runs over the city and harried New Republic forces. Those who were grounded took on the tasks of the Edict and Airy crew, whose escape pods had yet to be located. Six young women and men moved among the control room terminals, trying to bring neglected systems back online. Three more stood guard over the ties in the plaza, while another two attempted to patch simple damage to the ships. All of them sweated in their flight suits as they worked, though many had stripped off helmets and gloves as they rewired connections and called to one another over the holographic display table. None of them were meant for the work before them, but a TIE pilot was trained to be able to reassemble an ion engine, reprogram a targeting computer, or build a distress signal from the wreckage of a skyhopper. Pilots couldn't replace the command staff or ground crew of their carrier ships, but they were far from helpless.
"Do we have a data feed yet?" Soren asked.
Lieutenant Nord Candende, Gablerone's troubled officer, whom Soren had caught offering blood to the Emperor's messenger aboard the Airy, rose from his station and waved the others back to their tasks.
"We have a feed," Candende said. "Not a lot of data. We're merging sensor readings from all units and communications distance. They're chaining transmissions for extra range, though Squadron 3 keeps straying too far out."
"Good enough for now," Soren said.
He moved to the hollow table's edge and adjusted controls until the display flashed into life.
"But I want the plaza's main transmitter operational by sunset."
Candende hesitated, then hurried back to work. Soren had no idea whether a sunset deadline was remotely achievable, but he guessed Candende didn't either. Sometimes that was motivation enough. He stared into the shimmering holographic cityscape for over an hour, watching the firefly glow of TIEs crossing the map of Troyth. There were few non-shadow wing ships in flight when he began his vigil. By the end, there were none. Virtually no civilian vessels remained in Cerberon, and the governor's forces had been decimated over the previous months. That left only the survivors of General Syndulla's battle group, and they had gone into hiding at low altitude or left the range of the TIE's patrol patterns. For the moment, then, Shadow Wing was Cerberon's predominant air and space force. For the moment, its advantage was overwhelming. Even taking into consideration Syndulla's ground troops and assuming negligible aid from local Imperial loyalists, the 204th could lock down Troyth. As the situation became clear, Soren designated targets and spoke tersely over a calm frequency that made all his pilots sound like droids. And when the immediate threats had been destroyed, when the best fortified New Republic outposts had been hammered by TIE bombers and the scattered anti-air cannons obliterated, he recalled two squadrons and organized a unit rotation to allow his fatigued people short rests. That was the greatest reprieve he was comfortable offering. Ending the patrols altogether wasn't an option, given how rapidly enemy ground forces could potentially regroup. Troyth was a planet already exhausted by war, but exhaustion could resemble fortitude in extreme circumstances. Shadow Wing could not afford to become complacent. A proper casualty report was assembled at last, and Soren learned of three more pilots killed in the fighting. Two he had known: Thrail Lenora, a serious young recruit from an Agra world who joined the wing shortly before Endor, whom Soren had needed to coax into asking advice when required.
"Inexperience is not failure," he'd coached the boy while trying not to smile.
And Wilhona Breathe, the gentle patriot whose infant nervous system had been afflicted by separatist toxins in the Clone Wars, guaranteeing her a protracted death by the age of 40. They'd never spoken directly of this. The note was in her medical file, and Soren had said nothing, taking quiet pleasure as she bonded with her squadron mates and confessed her secret to one after the next. The third casualty was Bancroft Cassis, an ensign from Pandem Nye who had served as grandmother's shuttle pilot and been promoted to tie duty after her death. Soren had meant to meet with every new addition to the wing since his departure, but time had slipped away. Make no excuses. Focus on the question at hand. What do you do now? He had no way out of Cerberon without a carrier ship. He'd never intended to risk his people's lives capturing the planet. His mind oscillated between self-recriminations and a need for movement, a need to march out of the communications center, take off in his TIE fighter, and rush to the defense of those pilots still on patrol. You're falling apart, Soren. This would never have happened before Devon.
Sir,
a voice asked. He whirled and heard himself say in a harsh voice that inspired neither calm nor confidence, "What is it?" He stared across at a young woman with fresh burn scars covering her face and one arm in a makeshift sling. She still wore her pilot's uniform. He dredged a name from the depths of his memory. Lieutenant Falshoy. She didn't flinch at his unearned anger. She looked too weary and broken to flinch.
Bruce and his people are back from the supply run, she said. They've got a makeshift galley in one of the conference rooms. You should eat. I can bring you something.
Of course, he said. Thank you. He returned his gaze to the hologram and counted up the dead. He'd lost more people in a day than he had in a month prior to Endor, and the war for Troyth was only beginning. The melody of Gaborone's drinking song came back to him, and Soren imagined the captain looking at him with a mix of disdain and good humor. You wanted command of the unit, Gaborone's ghost told him. You sought the responsibility. What are you going to do with it? Food did nothing to calm him, but he ate. Reports from the front of scattered anti-air fire and riots on the ground, some pro-Republic, some pro-Imperial, each hard to differentiate from the other, did nothing to quell his desire to join his squadrons, but he listened. Soren Keyes eventually turned from the hologram of Troyth to charts of the Cerberon system. He assigned three flights to search for escape pods from the Edict and the Aerie and see if they'd made planetfall beyond the reach of Troyth's shields, in the planet's oceans or across the scarred continent. He chose other flights to leave Troyth, to patrol Cerberon and watch for vessels attempting to escape. The moment the New Republic received word of the system's fall, a countdown would begin, ending in Shadow Wing's defeat. No one could be allowed to depart Cerberon carrying a plea for reinforcements. He still didn't know what to do, though. It wasn't yet midnight when Candende reported an encrypted Imperial transmission coming in from one of the aging refinery districts at the north end of the continent. One of the TIE patrols had picked it up during its third pass over the region. Either the signal had just been activated, or it was weak enough to be nearly undetectable. Let's see it, Soren said. The display table flickered again. Ribbons of light coalesced and sculpted the head of a woman whose dark, youthful face was crowned by elaborate braids and gemstone studs. Her expression conveyed the formal dignity of someone for whom formality and dignity were all she had left. Creases under her eyes suggested the scars of exhaustion.
Someone receiving. Channel 92 Alpha, utilizing military clearance code 63 Delta Delta.
The woman went on, each syllable enunciated with marked determination. Soren didn't recognize the code and, without the Aerie or the Edict, had no way to confirm its authority. But he decided the risk of replying was minimal, and he adjusted the table's comm controls. This is Colonel Soren Keyes of the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing, he said. To whom am I speaking? If the woman was surprised, she didn't show it.
This is Acting Governor Farah Yadiz. It is a privilege to speak to you, Colonel.
Acting Governor? Sarin asked. Stress and weariness scraped at his brain as he attempted to recall facts he'd never expected to need. What's become of Governor Hastemore?
Killed by the rebels in the attack on the capital,
Yadiz replied. There was bitterness in her tone, but no sorrow.
The Cabinet and Advisory Council were hard hit over the past months. I don't know if you received our dispatches following Endor.
Only in part.
Then suffice it to say that the line of succession ends with me, Colonel. I am the rightful ruler of this planet, until such time as I am replaced by Sector Command or a higher authority.
Sarin wondered just how far Farah Yadiz had climbed. But he heard the implied question and said, I am not here to replace you, Governor. The Empire is grateful for your service in this chaotic time. It was a lie, but the polite sort of lie he imagined Yadiz might appreciate for what it was, or if not, simply accept as flattery.
We have very little information about the Loyalist forces on Troyth. Can you tell me your status?
I don't have a hidden army waiting to strike, if that's what you're wondering. We've mapped pockets of resistance, but haven't opened communications with the guerrilla fighters or the district leaders still loyal. The New Republic has been aggressive in containing us. I accept full responsibility for the state of things.
She forced the words out with obvious difficulty. Sarin admired the effort.
And would welcome whatever guidance you can provide.
Yadiz paused. Sarin watched her as her expression softened. For an instant, the formality and dignity dropped away and were replaced by a profound humanity.
Thank you for coming,
she said.
I'm not deluded enough to think that Cerberon was ever the Empire's top priority, and I don't know what made you decide to come now, but we've been dreaming of this day. Now we have a chance. Now we have hope.
She waited. We're not here to rescue your world, Sarin thought. He said nothing, and Farah Yadiz transformed back into the acting governor of Troyth.
Send me your location, Sarin said after another moment. We should meet face to face. We have a great deal to discuss.
2. They sat on the lowest level of a 3-story speeder garage and repair shop in the decaying High Garden district. The district was neither tall nor verdant, though Will had seen a handful of electro-fenced lots that might have been parkland in a different era. The garage itself had been built for maintenance droids and meter-high Ugnaught workers, and as a result, Will, Nath, and the 2 dozen soldiers, pilots, and support crew present had to take care not to smash their heads against the pipes and deactivated light fixtures above their scalps. The entire building buzzed with each distant explosion, every ion bomb bursting or mortar round hitting home. If there had been rain, Will could have pretended he was riding out a storm.
Fighting's getting worse on the east side,
an infantry soldier called out. He was crouched at the metal bars enclosing the garage, peering out with a pair of electro binoculars.
Lots of blaster flash. Handhelds, no cannons. Probably mostly pistols. Could be close enough for us to join them.
Will shifted on the Duracrete floor. Nath reached out beside him, gesturing as if ready to hold him back. But it was Sergeant Carver who spoke, rising slowly from where he'd been lying down.
No,
the burly man called.
No one's going anywhere. What's your thinking?
Nath asked. The other troops looked between Nath and Carver. Will recognized Nath's tone. The older pilot knew exactly what Carver would say and wanted to make sure he had the opportunity to say it.
First, this is our rendezvous point, and we've got 20, 30 stragglers who could still show. I want to be here to meet them if they do.
Carver scratched at his calves, then swept his gaze across the assembly, as if looking for anyone ready to argue.
Second, we walk into that mess, we've got a real good chance of losing. We don't know who's fighting. We don't know the terrain. If the locals are slaughtering one another, our odds of doing good by getting in the middle are piss poor. Remember Switchmount?
The man with the electro binoculars nodded slowly.
Madonna,
a woman's muffled voice called. Will had trouble locating her, until he noticed the bundle of torn blankets covering a lump in the corner.
Thank you, Twitch, Carver said. Besides, you know how a good riot goes. Always blows over by morning.
The sergeant grinned broadly like it was a joke. Will didn't get it, but Nath snickered beside him, and several of the other soldiers began laughing. It was Vitali who called out,
"We'll just wait till daylight, then."
And the meaning finally struck home. Will still didn't find it funny, yet he made himself smile. He'd heard worse among Riot Squadron, and he could have let it pass if it had ended there. Instead, the joke and the laughter seemed to rouse the troops' spirits, and they began speaking to one another about past battles, past incidents where local populations had been caught between the Company and the Empire, past fights where the 61st Mobile Infantry had been left for dead by the Rebel Alliance at large. Zab, the sergeant Will had met on the night Erica Quell had joined them for dinner in the refugee camp, spoke of the company's battle on the planet Sullust.
Lost our troop carrier that time. Lodestar was prettier, but nothing beat the...
This, in turn, set off a round of debate about the merits of the Lodestar. Will thought of the battleship falling toward Troyth, torn to pieces by the ties as it burst against the shield. He thought of the escape pods and wondered whether Quell had been among those lucky enough to depart. He didn't blame the infantry troops for their callousness. They hadn't been aboard the Lodestar long, nor had they witnessed its demise.
"Excuse me,"
he murmured to Nath, and he wobbled as he moved through the garage with his head bent forward, hands touching the ceiling to keep him balanced. Will spent the next hour on the garage's top floor, where the two fighters were stowed between industrial meat processors stinking of ammonia and splashed with green stains. The ceiling was tall enough for Will to stand erect, but the scent sufficed to drive the troops below. He was helping T5 weld a section of the Y-Wing's landing gear when heavy footsteps rang out on the grating, and he recognized Nath's bellow behind him.
"Not in the mood for conversation," he called.
"Too soon to laugh about the Lodestar is all," Will said, and shrugged.
"You don't like the infantry much, do you?"
Will turned about and rose, gently leaning against T5 as he did so. The droid squawked happily, apparently taking the gesture as a sign of affection.
"What makes you say that?"
Will asked.
"They seem like good people."
"You think that about Shadowing, too,"
Nath replied, and Will would have argued, but his mind went to blink.
"It's nothing to be ashamed of, but you'll spend half a day listening to the ground crew talk about their mothers, and you won't spare an hour for this sort."
"We don't have much in common."
"You don't much like fighting face to face, and you don't like being reminded that it happens."
Again, Will wanted to argue.
"Maybe,"
he said.
"If I insulted anyone down there, I'm sorry. I'll swing by after." "No one cares, brother. Just figure since we're stuck with them, you may as well be honest with yourself."
Nath inspected the welding job with a skeptical eye, but he didn't object to the results. They worked side by side until the heat of T5's arc welder left them sweating, and they climbed onto a ledge overlooking the streets of the Highgarden district. The wind was cold and the sky was dark, save for the eternally bright stars and the burning eye.
"Aiden didn't want us fighting them at all,"
Will said.
"No one wanted us fighting them. That's why half the infantry company is sitting on an asteroid somewhere, waiting to spring the trap and cut down the Empire's favorite pilots while they're not flying. But it looks like that didn't happen."
Will nodded carefully and let his legs dangle into the chill void. In the distance, he saw flashes of crimson light. The bombs had stopped falling.
It's our responsibility now, he said.
Only if you want it.
Nath was watching him, uncharacteristically somber.
It's our responsibility, Will said. We brought Shadow Wing here. We clean it up.
They sat in silence a long while. There were no sounds of city life, no humming speeders or laughter in the distance. Nath finally pushed back away from the edge of the ledge.
Get some sleep,
Nath said.
Infantry commanders are meeting in the morning. I got myself an invite, but I think you should be there.
The solar projectors did not ignite when morning came. Whether intentionally sabotaged or damaged in the fighting, no one knew. Either way, the city remained lit by starlight and the black hole. Enough to see by, enough to breakfast by, but an ever-present reminder that the skies belonged to shadows. More soldiers, no pilots among them, had trickled in during the night, but the complement from General Syndulla's battle group still numbered fewer than 50, mostly combat personnel with a smattering of support units. Perhaps another 20 volunteers had shown up, representing local Troith forces. Will wasn't sure how the qualifications for leadership had been determined, but the combined unit's 6 representatives sat with Will and Nath in a cramped, low-ceilinged office on the 2nd floor of the garage. Someone had connected an emergency generator to the computer system, and one cluster of soldiers sat muttering softly and staring at hollows of Troith. Carver was among the infantry squad commanders, as was the middle-aged woman called Twitch, who'd been hidden by blankets the night before. A bone-crested hook filled most of one corner with his silent bulk. A human named Vifra represented the surviving engineers and was so encrusted with ash, save for a few stripes down her face where she'd clearly wiped a sanitation cloth, that Will wondered if she'd spent the past few hours escaping a bombed building. An elderly human male called Junior stared blankly at the computer images and fiddled with a holographic toy. Finally, a slender female Sulliston announced that she'd been liaising with the local forces and would represent them at the meeting. Will hadn't caught her name. Carver raised his voice when they'd all assembled.
Basically, we're up to our necks again. Captain's floating on an asteroid somewhere, wondering why Shadow Wing hasn't shown up. Which means, officially, command of the 61st Mobile Infantry passes to me.
Several of the others protested. Carver cut them off.
However, since we're guests of the locals, and our Starfighter Corps friends officially outrank us all, I figure we ought to chat as a group.
Will and Nath exchanged a glance. If the man didn't realize that Alphabet Squadron was part of New Republic intelligence and not officially military, now wasn't the time to bring it up.
If no one objects, Carver continued in a tone that made it clear objections weren't welcome, let's go around and run down what we've got to work with. After that, we look at the state of the planet. Then we talk options.
They did as Carver suggested, and it became apparent that conditions were worse than Will had expected. The company was not only understaffed, but also under-equipped. Most of the squads had been routed by Shadow Wing bombing runs and fled their positions unprepared. Twit reported that one of her squad was armed only with a combat knife. Vifra wasn't encouraging about the prospect of contacting other scattered infantry units. Any signal likely to get through, she said, was also likely to be traced by the Empire. By comparison, Alphabet's munitions depleted A-Wing and aging Y-Wing were shining beacons of New Republic combat readiness. They moved on to the tactical situation next. The Sulliston had pieced together reports regarding the riots and enemy bombing campaign. The district Syndulla's battle group had left untouched en route to the capital were in chaos, with small numbers of heavily armed Imperial guerrillas attempting to lock down territory. Shadow Wing patrol patterns had shifted, prioritizing oversight of territories sympathetic to the New Republic. Bombing runs had decreased in frequency over the past 12 hours, But the 204th remained quick to obliterate whole city blocks whenever an uprising began.
"We have one report of Ties heading off-world," the Sulliston finished. "We couldn't confirm it. Still, it's possible they're spreading through the whole system."
"Who cares?" Twitch asked. "We're grounded, unless you're going somewhere."
She jutted a thumb at Will and Nath and smiled nastily. Will simply shook his head.
"Way I see it," Carver said, "our best bet is to reestablish a base of operations, probably by taking it from the enemy. We hit hard and fast, we bring up anti-air defenses, and we become a rallying point for the rest of our forces. From there, we figure out where the enemy fighters are based." A fresh chorus of arguments began.
Will didn't participate. He felt unqualified to judge the plan. Though he recognized its flaws as well as anyone, he had no confidence in any alternatives he could propose. He listened as the others debated the company's anti-air capabilities and traveling speed. He readied himself to speak up and describe Shadow Wing's capabilities, the damage that a proton bomb could do, but no elaboration was required. The commanders were debating how to survive the foe long enough to receive reinforcements or assemble a superior plan, not how to destroy it. Will watched their expressions. If he'd known the commanders better, he could have dug deeper, drawn out hidden reservations. If they'd been at odds, he could have played peacemaker, but his skills were useless here.
"Not to state the obvious," Nath said after Junior began to cough and the others made the error of pausing, "but the governor didn't have the anti-air guns to take out our fighters. We've got a total of 6 or 7 surface-to-air missiles, which won't put a dent in Shadow Wing. Without a way to keep those Ties grounded, there's no point getting clever."
"Big enough ion pulse could knock them all out of the sky," Vifra muttered.
Carver didn't hide his irritation. "If we had those kinds of warheads, we wouldn't be debating what to do." The rumble of bombings resumed. Will looked at the ash on Vifra's cheeks and tried to imagine how far Shadow Wing would go to destroy what was left of the New Republic military. He thought of walkers toppling skyscrapers and the burning skies of Pandem Nai. He looked at the map of the city and the planet, staring into the hologram until the light burned his eyes.
"We should retreat," he said.
Too soft at first, but when he repeated himself, the others looked to him.
"We should retreat."
"Nowhere to run, boy,"
Twitch said. She snickered. No one else did. "The 204th has destroyed planets before," Will said. "So long as we're in the city, they won't hesitate to raise whole districts. Kill..." He glanced at the Sulliston, ready for her to correct his numbers.
"Millions? Billions?"
"The governor was invested in the world in a way Shadow Wing isn't. This conflict will be different."
"We can't afford to fight here.
Every minute we stay, every minute they hunt us, we're putting the civilian population in danger."
"Then we disband."
Vifra looked among the others, searching for agreement.
"If we can't do much damage anyway, we go underground.
Become rebels again. Spread out and hold on until something changes."
"What if that something is Imperial reinforcements instead of New Republic ones?" Carver asked. "There's a reason we never scatter without a plan to reunite. We wouldn't be in this mess if half the company weren't in space." The Hook shifted, glowering at Carver and cracking open his massive jaw before being interrupted by Junior. The human had set his toy aside and was manipulating the hologram.
"What about the other side?" Junior asked.
The hollow image of the planet spun fast enough to render the image a blur before reforming on the scar of Troyth. The lifeless, mined-out continent that had provided the raw materials for the city.
"No civilians to worry about," Carver conceded.
"But what are we supposed to do out there?"
The Sulliston squatted beside Junior at the holo display, rapidly adjusting settings and magnifying the desolation. Something blinked among the rocky plains and chasms.
"The last of the mining mega facilities was never scrapped.
The shaft goes kilometers underground. It was used for core drilling and bulk freighter launches decades back.
Is it deep enough to take hits from a TIE bomber and stay intact?
Vifra asked.
Take a look.
The Celestin shrugged. The arguing resumed as the Celestin pulled up what outdated technical readouts were available on the public network. Carver suggested that retreat was neither wise nor necessary, but couldn't address Will's concerns regarding civilian casualties. Twitch appeared disinterested until Junior raised the question of transporting the company across such a long distance, at which point she became viciously opposed to the death march she anticipated would destroy her squad. But the mining facility appeared defensible.
Maybe we can get there without anyone noticing, Junior said. Maybe we can launch attacks from there.
Hit-and-run strikes from a safe position could open things up, Carver conceded.
Buy time. Give the locals room to maneuver.
If we give you flyboys a secure fallback position, you think you can take on the foe? Will looked to Nath, but Nath waited for him. Cautiously, Will worked through the logic aloud.
Every time we've been beaten by Shadow Wing, it's because they chose the terms of engagement. They're good at what they do, but they're not invincible.
Even so, he spoke without flinching. We've only got 2 starfighters. Carver sighed loudly. He'd begun to speak when Nath interrupted.
We don't need starfighters. We just need air power. Maybe it's time to lower our standards.
Meaning what? Carver asked.
Mr. Lark here used to fly birds on his homeworld, Nath said. Big city world like Troyth. You going to tell me there's nothing that'll lift off?
The Celestin and Vifra spoke almost simultaneously.
Civilian airspeeders, the Celestin said. Or maybe some rusting police cruisers from before the Empire, but we've got portable cannons, heavy rifles.
Vifra screwed up her face.
I can weld and wire. We're still talking about vehicles that can't match TIEs for speed or firepower.
Nath grinned, showing white teeth.
TIEs aren't much match for an X-Wing either. Like Will said, we choose the terms of engagement. We make sure we've got a clear line of retreat. We build an air unit of our own. We operate from the mega facility. We make a difference.
Say we get you a unit. Everyone looked to Carver now.
You can lead it?
Hell no. Nath leaned back and kicked out his legs before jutting a thumb at Will.
That's what he's here for.
They didn't speak in private again until late afternoon, when Will caught up to Nath as the older man readied the Y-Wing for flight.
Tell me why,
Will said. Nath squatted on the vessel's hull, roughly jiggling T5 back and forth until the droid locked into the socket. He didn't pretend not to understand.
Maybe I didn't want to spend the day looking over personnel reports, deciding who among the ground pounders is qualified to fly. You'd be better at it than me.
Will craned his neck, trying to make out Nath's expression in the dim light.
I've handled field command before, when I had to. You've run a proper squadron, and you know these people better than I do. They love you. They'll be glad to follow you.
They do love me, Nath said, because I've put in more hours than you have. But they respect you already. Not just because we've saved their butts, but because you're the Palinian. Turns out Meteor Squadron's been sharing your legend.
Will laughed.
Nath didn't. The Y-Wing emitted a metallic grinding noise and began to hum.
I believe that you've been sharing my legend. Again, the question is, why? Put it this way, I don't want command of these people. If you don't take it, no one does.
Will tried to read the man. He couldn't see the reasoning, but he recognized the inflexibility.
All right, he said.
Whatever the full truth was, Nath wasn't wrong.
That mean you're taking my orders too?
That's the plan. In an instant, the charming pirate, the con man, returned. I'll see you in a while, with ships in tow. Unless Shadow Wing finds me first.
Three. Quell woke, unable to breathe or feel her limbs. There was pressure on her chest and pressure on her back, and her attempts to escape whatever squeezed her were rebuked with sharp pain down her spine. She realized she was lying face down, and centimeter by centimeter she rose, forcing bruised fingers, she could see her hands if not fully sense them, against unstable metal paneling until the pressure alleviated and she could suck in lungfuls of thin air. When oxygen had returned to her brain, she saw that she was still on the bridge of the freighter. The pilot's seat had uprooted from the deck and lodged her body between itself and the main console, perhaps a stroke of luck, since the transparent metal of the viewport had torn open in three places, leaving jagged halos that could have easily impaled a body. Sand the color of blood had poured inside through the gaps, and a cold, high-pitched wind whistled and fondled Quell's torso and head. The breeze alerted her to a sore spot on her temple where her hair felt glued in place. She didn't need to touch her face to know that the locks were matted and sticky with gore. Her memory chip necklace, meanwhile, had cut into her chest and left a stinging gash. She was alive. This was the most surprising of her findings. She attempted to pull away from seat and console, discovered she was still constrained by the safety harness, and spent several minutes disentangling herself after concluding that the automatic release didn't function. The process dizzied her, but allowed her to confirm that all of her limbs were operative and her blood loss was under control. If she had broken bones, and she suspected she did, given she broke more easily than she bruised, they were bones that weren't supporting anything vital. Fractures in ribs or fingers, maybe a shoulder. She hoped not a shoulder this time. She eased out of the cockpit and into the access corridor. The entire vessel was canted 10 degrees or more, which forced her to find footholds for every step. She was intent enough on maintaining her balance and fighting down bile that she was 2 meters along the hallway before she realized the entire port side of the ship was gone. Bulkheads and compartments torn away, interior exposed to the same sand and darkness as the cockpit. She considered the implications, irreparable damage to the freighter to start with, and filed the facts away. Her next stop was the starboard cabin where she'd left Aiden and ITO. She might have called out if she'd been feeling up to speech, but her jaw ached and the bile was still attempting to rise. With no working lighting and no starlight penetrating the ship's depths, she had to feel her way around the last bend and wait for her eyes to adjust upon reaching the room. A jumble of geometric lines resolved into ruins. The bunks had toppled, and a mass of tubing had ripped free from the wall, burying most of the floor. Quell spotted Cairn Aiden's hand and traced it to his body. The intelligence officer's form was covered by one of the bunks, but appeared intact. Quell couldn't tell if he was breathing. She knelt to rest as much as to take a pulse. Aiden's hand was warm. Quell felt the rhythm of his heartbeat. You could leave him. The thought surprised her, but she followed its course. He had betrayed her, exposed her crimes to her squadron, ensured she would have no future in the New Republic or anywhere else. She'd chosen to let him live when she'd rescued him from his captors, but now? Now she had a second chance. She groaned in misery as she raised the bunk, wedging her knee to prop it in position and gripping Aiden under his shoulders. She pulled, knowing she was liable to exacerbate any injuries he might have, but leaving him buried couldn't be any better. She rested and caught her breath once she'd freed him, then felt the body sliding on the canted floor and heard creaking metal.
All the way, then,
she thought, and dragged him out into the access corridor and onto the red sand. The wreckage of the freighter provided shelter against the wind. A strong breeze raised plumes that crossed the arid plain like phantoms. The bright starlight was filtered through the clouds of the debris field, but the fiery iris of Cerberon's eye crested the horizon like an obscene rainbow, fierce enough to see by. Past the crater wall created by the ship's crash, the red desert appeared endless, rolling into low dunes no taller than Quell's knees. It was as if a sea of blood had been locked in stasis, its waves paralyzed and left to dry until all that was water was now dust. Quell sat beside Aiden and realized she was breathing heavily from the effort of moving him. She reassessed her condition. Her garments were torn, and cuts and abrasions covered the backs of her hands. She'd instinctively stretched one leg out and tucked the other beneath her, contorting her body to reduce the worst of the pain in her spine. She was gathering the strength to return to the ship when Aiden shifted beside her. He lay on his back and rolled onto a shoulder before dropping again.
Where?
He breathed.
We're still in the debris field, Quell said.
She coughed upon finishing the sentence, smelled a foulness in her breath, and spat a few grains of sand.
It was land here or nowhere.
Aiden squeezed his eyes shut, reopened them, and carefully turned his head.
Aito.
Quell was surprised to realize how little she'd thought about the droid since waking.
I don't know, she said.
She mentally retraced her path through the ship. With most of the freighter gone, there weren't many places for the droid to hide. She searched memories of the rubble for the black sphere or the light of the droid's photoreceptor. She found nothing.
The ship came apart on descent, Quell added.
She looked to the horizon again.
I don't think Aito is with us.
Aiden shuffled backward, propping himself on his elbows and then his palms.
We need to find it, he snapped, though his voice was too weak to carry. Figure out where Ido's gone immediately.
She recognized the tone and flinched. She was in Traitor's Remorse again, aboard the buried treasure again, in the ready room of the Lodestar, being put down by a man who saw every failure as rebellion. The Aiden whose company she'd grown fond of, the man she'd shared meals with on Troyth, worked with to sway the general, and laughed with on cold mornings while her squadron was flying, was suddenly gone. Quell stared into white eyes in a dark face.
Not now,
she said, but she kept her voice soft and lowered her gaze to the sand.
We're not in any condition to go out there.
Aiden's breath came quickly, as the strain of staying upright appeared to settle into his bones.
I won't abandon my droid.
If the droid is offline, leaving it alone a few hours more won't make any difference. She rose onto her knees, squatting beside Aiden.
We should salvage anything we can use to survive. Food, water, maybe a tarp, anything resembling a med kit. Then make camp and see to our injuries. There'll be time to look for the torture unit tomorrow.
There was no force in her words. She doubted she had the strength for defiance. Yet she saw the panic burn off Aiden's face and be replaced by something colder and calmer and just as bitter.
Tomorrow,
he agreed.
I like Aito too,
she murmured as she rose to her feet. They spent the next hour searching the wreckage in silence. Quell moved more swiftly than Aiden, but she noticed him doing what he was able, albeit usually from a seated position. They found little worth having, with Quell's prize being a mini evaporator, enough to supply water for one person each day in an ideal planetary atmosphere, less if Quell's luck held steady. The crushed but in-the-wrapper meal packs Aiden located in the cockpit would provide a solid week of sustenance if rationed carefully, and would potentially offer additional hydration. The arsenal Quill had taken from the Lodestar had disappeared. She suspected the hole in the cockpit viewport might be connected. They made camp around the side of the ship, as far from the wind as they could get, and hung sheets to form a thin and ineffective tent. They lay on a tarp beside each other, close enough to share body heat, but turned so that Aiden stared at the freighter's broken hull and Quell looked at rippling fabric. She was tired, but she doubted she could sleep.
"What happened to Kairos?"
Aiden asked, in barely more than a whisper.
"You asked that already," she wanted to say. "That was the first thing you asked when I saved your life." "She was with the medics. She's alive now, unless something happened."
Unless Shadow Wing had obliterated her. Unless Quell's efforts to give her squadron a chance had failed. She began to think about what might have occurred after Soren Keyes had savaged her freighter and flown on to the battle over Troyth. But wondering whether Lark and Tenzint and Chaddock were still breathing wouldn't help her now. Speculating whether the Lodestar was intact wouldn't help either.
"Erica,"
Aiden said. She grunted in acknowledgement, then thought to say,
"What?" "The mission was yours. If anything happens to her, if anything happens to Kairos, I will hold you responsible."
Aiden said nothing after that, and Quell shifted, digging her head into the sand through the tarp. She wasn't concerned. What more could Aiden do to her? Chapter 15. Fantasies of Grander Days. 1. In the shrouded lands between sleep and waking, Chas Nachadik found she was young again. The faraway singing that reached her ears was the singing she'd heard every day since her 8th birthday, when her mother had insisted they pack their few belongings and trek to the Benevolence Tower on the outskirts of New Vertica in the sprawling city of Nar Shaddaa. The tower was different from anywhere they'd lived before, and what Chas remembered most about Benevolence was the whiteness, illumination so foreign to the smog and neon streets, so pervasive that her eyes hurt at the end of the day. Where windows had once looked into gutters, the inhabitants had bolted ivory cloth or, in a few cases, grown trellises of thick green vines. This was so no one could look in, Chas was told by her mother, so no one could spy on them and learn the secrets of the inheritors of the crystal. It had taken Chas 2 years to realize it was really so no one could look out. But during her early days in Benevolence, before she'd grasped that her mother had dragged her into a cult amassing weapons and followers for a spice-crazed lunatic, a man who'd decided a charismatic smile and a replica kyber crystal were the basis for a religion, Chas had felt a peace she'd rarely experienced since. She'd been treated as equal to the adults, which seemed exploitative now, but at the time had felt like a privilege, and had cooked meals and repaired malfunctioning septic tanks and polished the crystal and cataloged weapons with the rest of them. When her mother spent increasing time with the Prophet, she ignored it because, after all, what did she need a mother for? They were all family among the inheritors. She'd truly believed that, and she'd excused the undercurrent of dread, the constant fear of failure, fear of the consequences of failure, as something that was part of all families, part of what it meant to love a community and feel responsible for its fate. Eventually, she'd learned better. Nonetheless, while Chas had lived in harsher places before and after Benevolence, she remembered how unbearably alone she'd felt in the days after fleeing. How it felt to be shunned as an unbeliever, disconnected from the cosmic force. She'd told herself that she no longer accepted the Prophet's teachings, but she had believed, in her bones. When Chas woke after failing to repair her B-wing and nearly suffocating in the void of space, she heard singing, and for a moment,
she believed again. It felt glorious. The singing was real. She jerked upright and found herself wrapped in a musty linen cargo pad on the floor of a starship's gunwale. The cannon itself was gone, and most of the viewport was covered in colorful drapery and cloth scrolls proclaiming, "The Force is life and fellowship is creation." Her mouth was dry and her lips felt tacky, but she was surprisingly alert for someone who should have been dead. The singing, chanting, really, was tinny and garbled. Chess unrolled the cargo pad, wobbled to her feet, and followed the sound down a short hallway. Through an open hatch, she spied a circular command center decorated in the same style as the turret and occupied by three crew members gathered around a hologram. The chanting ended. The hollow showed a middle-aged humanoid woman whose skin was covered in colorful blotches of fungal growth, dozens of tiny mushrooms fruiting from shoulder and cheek and ear like patches on a threadbare uniform. Chas was seized by competing urges to look away in disgust and to stare in awe. There was something inherently compelling, if not commanding, about the woman's serene and tolerant expression. Something familiar as well. And it was when the woman began speaking that Chas recalled where she'd seen her before.
"For this lesson, we will speak of fellowship and technology. You may have asked yourself, why do the children of the empty sun reject droids? I'd much rather have a machine haul water or repair a comm system than do it myself."
Chas swore softly. The cultists in the Troyth refugee camp had stared at hollows for hours on end, too. "Our guest is awake, eh?" one of the crew called and paused the recording. He, too, was familiar. The burn scars across his cheeks and scalp and the colorful swatches of his outfit brought her back to a hazy night at Winkers. It was the man who had saved her from the Verk and tried to recruit her.
"Where am I?" Chas snarled.
She reached for her sidearm and found nothing on her hip. "We call this vessel Groiver's Skiff because I'm Groiver, and this is my solar skiff. It used to have another name before I walked the path, but what good is treating machines like people if it leads to treating people like machines?" He rose from his seat, saw Chas tense, and settled again.
"We found you floating in space. You're lucky we got there when we did."
"You found me?"
Competing questions fought through Chas's brain, and she asked the one whose answer would be easiest to bear.
"You mean you tracked me? You've been following me since Winkers?"
"There's little coincidence in a universe directed by the Force," Groiver said, "but that's an awfully suspicious leap."
"You're not denying it," Chas thought. She swore again and marched into the room, shouldering a white-furred woman with horns and fangs away from the comscan terminal. The readouts showed little except the ship's rapid approach toward Katadra.
"What happened with the battle? The carrier, the Star Destroyer?"
"No long-range scans on a solar skiff,"
the furry woman sneered in a nearly impenetrable accent.
"Nor light speed, nor guns, nor hypermatter reactor," Groiver added, "which is probably why the TIEs haven't stopped us. I'm sorry, lass, but by all accounts, the New Republic's lost. We heard that battlecruiser of yours went down over Troyth, and there's been only Imperial transmissions since then." Anger flashed through her. She thought about how her comrades might have died. Swift exposure to vacuum, annihilation by particle bolts, incinerator.